I think when we get ourselves into these real lower vibrations, these difficult situations that we sometimes find we're never going to get out of them, but we do. And it's often we look back at those times and go, that was the best thing that ever happened to me, because if I had not been through that, I wouldn't be where I am today.
Steve Jobs said, we can't connect the dots of life looking forward. We can only do it looking backwards. It's so easy in the moment to categorize things as being a bad experience or a good experience, rather than zooming out and going, well, we don't actually know until it plays out. There's a beautiful saying in positive psychology that challenge without meaning is suffering, but challenge with meaning is growth. And so for me, I can now look back on these really challenging chapters of life and see the meaning in them, see the purpose in them, and go, ah, that's why that had to happen.
Thank you so much for tuning in to the Career Confidence Podcast today. It honestly means the world to me. Now, before we dive into today's episode, I wanted to let you know about something I have been working on behind the scenes. So as you know from listening, I am writing a book called The Bold Move. And alongside the book, I am also developing something that is really going to help people in this current world of work. Now, what I'm hearing from so many people is there is a lot of uncertainty, there's fear, there's lack of confidence, lack of clarity. People are generally concerned about their careers and what the world is going to look like over the next 5 or 10 years. And no wonder, because stats like 44% of workers are going to have to change careers by 2028, according to the World Economic Forum. 300 million jobs could be impacted by AI globally. And then the fact that, according to LinkedIn, 60% of professionals don't know what their next step should be. It's no surprise that there is a lot of confusion in the market right now. And I really want to do everything in my power to help. So alongside an amazing team, I've created a AI-powered career mentor called Pivotr, spelled P-I-V-O-T-R, pivotr.com. And what this tool is going to give you is everything you need to succeed in this new world of work. Whether you're looking to pivot into a completely different industry, learn AI, and make sure you're staying ahead in your career, pivot up in your current industry, go for that promotion, or even a pivot project, you want to launch your own thing, Pivotr is going to be your career mentor in this new uncertain world of work. It's going to give you that clarity. It will give you that personalized roadmap and break it down into weekly sprints so you know exactly what to do to get you to where you want to be. It's also going to have voice enablement so you can chat to Pivotr anytime you need that little bit of comfort, clarity, certainty. The AI tool and Pivotr is going to be there to support you and guide you every single step of the way. Now, we are only looking for a handful of people to test the product as it's in very, very early stages. So if you'd like to be involved, please go to pivotr.com. We'll make sure that we put it in the show notes, and reach out to me if you'd like to know more about the tool I'm creating. But I really, really am looking forward to launching this. And as the listeners of the Career Confidence Podcast, you'll be the first to know when the tool is ready for you. So go to pivotr.com, check it out, pop your name on that early access list. You do not want to miss out on the opportunity to be one of the first to use this. Your feedback is going to be very, very valued and will shape the future of this product. So thank you so much again for tuning in today. And now over to today's episode. Declan, welcome to the Career Confidence Podcast today. I'm absolutely delighted to have you on. We're going to be talking all things happiness today, and hopefully everyone's going to leave this conversation with the tools, the strategies, and these little tips that people can implement into their lives that can really hopefully help them feel happier in their day-to-day lives. But before we dive into everything, can you give the audience a little bit of an intro into yourself, your background, and what got you so interested and fascinated about this topic? So Declan, over to you.
Definitely. Thank you. First and foremost, thank you so much for having me on the show. I know we spoke a little bit before pressing record about how now more than ever, happiness is needed, and talking about the skills and science of happiness and making them accessible is more needed than ever. And any opportunity I have to share my research and my background and some of those tangible tips for living a happier, more fulfilling life is something that I don't take for granted. So thank you for having me here. As you mentioned, happiness is now my bread and butter that I've built a career around, which still feels a little odd. I still sometimes struggle. You know, when you're flying into a country and they ask you to put on the customs form, what do you do for work? That is still a challenging question for me, because I'm like, well, I'm a happiness research, happiness coach, happiness consultant for workplaces. I'm affectionately known on LinkedIn as that happiness guy, because I started going to events and people went, wait, I think I know you and your work. Aren't you that happiness guy? You talk about happiness a lot. And so I leant in and went, yeah, you know what? I am that happiness guy. And how I ended up becoming that happiness guy and ended up in the space where my career is dedicated to understanding the science of happiness and making that more accessible is, for a lot of my life, quite frankly, I wasn't happy. I wrestled with my own emotional well-being. I wrestled with self-doubt and self-criticism. I had a really loud inner critic that still occasionally pops up. I really wrestled with even something as seemingly simple as knowing who I was, right? Like, I talk a lot about this idea of, we tend to chase things like self-worth, self-esteem, self-care, self-compassion, self-confidence. These are all traits that people go, I would love more of that in my life. And they all start with the same bloody word for a reason, right? They all start with self. And so for me, for a lot of my life, I was like, I don't even know who I am. What are my values? What matters to me? What do I want in life? What does a happy life mean to me rather than to other people? And so what that led to was, thankfully, some great mentors and professionals stepping into my life and kind of being, you know, a bit of a big brother mentoring sort of role for me. And I started to ask them, wait, how do you guys know all this stuff? Like, it's almost like you've got a toolkit that I was never exposed to in school. Things like emotional intelligence and, you know, having a good relationship with ourselves. And they all kept saying the same thing. They're like, well, we've gone and looked into fields like mindfulness, like positive psychology, like acceptance and commitment therapy. And I just kept finding that they were referencing these toolkits that I'd never had prior exposure to. So off I went, and when I'm going to go learn more about that. And the more I learned about it, the more I fell in love with it and went, ah, okay, this is learnable. You know, the classic, I think there's a Chinese proverb that says, the best time to plant a tree was 20 years ago, but the next best time is today. And I really felt that. This was my late teens, early 20s by this point, where I went, I wish I had learned these skills much earlier in life, but here I am learning them now. And on that became to doing postgraduate studies in positive psychology, studying mindfulness-based stress reduction, studying acceptance and commitment therapy. And then one day saying to my fiance at the time, now my wife, thankfully, stayed with me throughout this decision. I said, I think I want to open a happiness college, a place where people can learn these skills and learn the skills to be happier and better human beings, not just great employees. And geez, that was now 8 years ago.
Wow. There's so many interesting things that you've just said then, which I'm going to dive into. But the really thing that really stands out for me, and I hear this a lot, and it's been very apparent in my own journey, is that we often go through things in our lives that lead us down paths that perhaps we didn't think we were going to go down. So you said that you were unhappy, you didn't feel, you know, maybe even a slight bit of depression there. I went through severe anxiety, which led me down a path to really understand myself, what my drivers were, what my values were, what was important to me. And I think that what I came to realize, and I'd love to hear your journey on what you realized when you were sort of discovering self, was that I did compare myself a lot to other people. I thought that's what happiness is. And I was it was always like something that I was going to attain in the future. I'll be happy, fill in the blank. And the more I've dug into my own sort of, I guess, understanding self, what's important to me, the more I've realized that actually happiness is just, it's in the day-to-day moments. It's when I'm fully present. It's when I'm with family and friends. And it's when I'm like in deep flow with my work. And it's not something that I now think is a future destination. But I'd love to sort of dive into like how sometimes I think when we get ourselves into these real lower vibrations, these difficult situations that actually we sometimes find we're never going to get out of them. But we do. And it's often we look back at those times and go, that was the best thing that ever happened to me. Because if I had not been through that, I wouldn't be where I am today.
Yeah, I think it was Steve Jobs, who said, "We can't connect the dots of life looking forward. We can only do it looking backwards." And I mm-hmm. see that being so true in my life and in a lot of people's lives I've been fortunate enough to have conversations with. They look back and in hindsight, we go, well, actually, that led to this. And then that had to happen to lead me here. And you know, who knows whether I would be doing what I'm doing today. And I'm fortunate to be very fulfilled and ironically very happy in my life and in myself and what I'm doing now. And you're right. I think it's so easy in the moment to categorize things as being a bad experience or a good experience rather than zooming out and going, well, we don't actually know until it plays out. That chapter of my life that I shared that kind of kickstarted me on being curious about the science of happiness, if you asked me at the time, I would have said this is a terrible chapter of life. And if you ask me now about it, I go, it was a meaningful chapter of life. Don't get me wrong, I'm not saying it was great and enjoyable and sunshine and rainbows, but I can see the meaning and purpose in it. And it's actually something I'm a big fan of. There's a beautiful saying in positive psychology that challenge without meaning is suffering, but challenge with meaning is growth. And so for me, I can now look back on these really challenging chapters of life and see the meaning in them, see the purpose in them and go, ah, that's why that had to happen. So then it feels a little bit more like a chapter of growth rather than a chapter of suffering. And to your other point of, you know, that comparison trap, and even we call it in the happiness research, the hedonic treadmill, the I'll be happy when trap. Oh, it's a slippery one to get into. Even as a happiness researcher, I end up on that more often than, you know, than I'd like to. And the goal is to kind of catch it early and go, oh, I'm in that I'll be happy when trap. Let's address it. I think when it comes to happiness, we need to start asking ourselves, and I encourage everyone listening to this conversation to ask yourself, what is your reference point for happiness? Because if it's external or future oriented, so external being comparison to others, and boy, oh boy, is it easier than ever to do that thanks to social media. It's easier than ever to have an external reference point for our own happiness and to compare to that. Or if it's too based in the future, the I'll be happy when trap, chances are we're going to feel like we're always chasing happiness, always pursuing it, but never quite experiencing it, never really achieving it and realizing it. Whereas if we have an internal reference point for happiness, be it, am I living in alignment with my values? Am I utilizing my strengths as a person? Do I feel that I'm bringing as often as possible, being realistic, it's not going to happen all the time, but as often as possible, do I feel like I'm bringing the best version of myself to my loved ones and to my pursuits that I care about, like my work or you know, hobbies? If our answer to those questions is yes, more likely than not, we're going to feel quite happy in life. And happiness doesn't just mean this fleeting feeling of joy or pleasure. Again, there's so many different forms of happiness. Sometimes it's connection, contentment, it's calm, it's excitement, it's joy. It's, you know, there's all these different expressions that would sit under the emotional umbrella term that is happiness. But if you want to experience those more often than not, I'd encourage you to start with what is my internal reference point for what it means to live a happy life.
I'm going to be really honest now, and because I really would love your thoughts on this, right? So I have maybe had a story in the past that if I allow myself to feel contentment, gratitude, happiness, I'm going to lose my ambition, my hunger. And I've often used that lack of like fulfillment as a fuel to drive me, to make me want to sell more, do more, be more. And don't get me wrong, it's definitely been a good driving force over the years. But there has been a very bad dark side to it, the anxiety being one of them. What are your thoughts on that? And can we be still goal-orientated, driven, if we are really happy, content? Like, I'd love to get your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I'm glad you asked it. I often joke with people that within all of us, there's these two parts of ourselves wrestling with each other. We all have like this inner CEO, high achiever, drive to perform. And we all have this inner monk that's like, let's be present and mindful and calm and connected. And it's like they're playing tug of war with our brain. And both of them have strengths. I think the goal here is to go, how do we get these two working together on the same team rather than against each other? And so what that looks like is giving it a very clear and compelling vision or purpose for what we do. And when I say purpose, I don't mean like big capital P purpose of what's the purpose of life. I mean, if you can answer that for yourself, fantastic, go to town. It's more, are we bringing a sense of purposefulness, right? Like, are we being purposeful with our choices, with our actions, with what we do day to day? Are we being intentional with it? On the topic of, you know, getting that little competitive edge from unhappiness, I mean, that's basic biology, right? It's a very human thing to do. At its core, we can talk about behavioral change coming from, you know, value alignment, from our own self-growth, from emotional intelligence, but at its fundamental root cause, the thing that leads people to do things in life is either the avoidance of pain or the pursuit of pleasure. That is it. We're either moving away from pain or moving towards pleasure. And for a lot of people, by the way, myself included, I'll put my hand up too. I think you and I have both done this in the past. We over-rely on the pain motivation to make change, right? The fear of failure, the fear of letting others down, the I'm not good enough yet, or I'm not, insert whatever word you want, enough, right? I'm not smart enough. I'm not successful enough. I'm not talented, whatever it may be. But if I go do this, if I achieve this, then that's going to solve that. That can be a really potent fuel for action. The downside, as you mentioned, is we gamble our self-worth and self-esteem on it. We gamble our well-being and happiness on it. It comes with a very big side dose of anxiety, overwhelm, burnout, exhaustion, disconnection from others and from ourselves. So then some people do this overcorrect where they go, well, that hasn't worked for me. Being driven by pain motivation does not work. I'm going to just be driven by pleasure motivation. And you know what these people end up as? I love them. I've been there myself. I call them the inspired procrastinators. Like, they can tell you the best stories, the biggest picture, the biggest goals. They can talk about the future and the project, and they can really rally everyone, inspire, but then nothing bloody gets done because there's no consequence. There's no cost of inaction. There's no pain motivation. So the way I like to think about it with people is, like, pain motivation will start the journey. It will get you started to make change. But as soon as you've started, as soon as we're past that big leap of inertia, as soon as the boulder is rolling, as quick as possible, we need to move to pleasure motivation, which is not what am I moving away from, but what am I moving towards? Why do I want to do this? Why am I choosing to do this? What am I feeling compelled by here? If we can answer those questions, it bridges the gap from, hey, use pain motivation to start, but as quick as possible, let's switch it into something a bit more sustainable, a bit healthier, a bit more long-term, which is that pleasure motivation.
Yeah, that's just so powerful. And I'm smiling because, yeah, I think you and I have maybe been on a similar journey. And now I really try and tap into, like, that vision. Like, one of the things I do every morning, and I'd love to sort of, like, dive into some, like, some real things that can really move us towards a state of happiness and things that also move us away. So I'd love to sort of, like, do sort of the do's and the don'ts in a second. But every morning without fail, I do a visualization meditation, and that just sort of starts the day for me of, like, this is where I'm going. These are my intentions. This is who I want to be. And I have found that to be a really profound exercise in my life. I've got a very active mind, shall we say. So just that sort of, I guess, awareness of where my thoughts are at for the morning. And it's so interesting. If you do that and you become more self-aware, you go, oh, triggered by that. Oh, still holding on to that. Oh, yep, need to let that go. Fascinating to be more, again, self-aware of yourself. So, and I want to dive into emotional intelligence and all of that as well. There's lots to talk about. But just to make this really, really tangible for people and to really get people thinking, what are some things that really can steal happiness? Like, what do you see? What are some patterns that people do in our society right now that is stealing people's happiness? Let's start there.
Yeah, so I'll look first at the psychological patterns that kind of really get in the way of happiness, and they kind of block a lot of happiness from us. Expectations is a big one. So either expectations we place on ourselves, expectations we place on others, expectations we place on just life to go to plan. There's a great saying, expectation is the root of all heartache. It's often attributed to Shakespeare, but whether or not he said it or wrote it, who knows? A lot of things get attributed to Shakespeare. So I would say, like, quoted by Shakespeare, and then in brackets, maybe. But the important part of the lesson is there's a lot of truth that to a lot of our stresses, a lot of our frustrations we experience in life, a lot of our anxiousness we experience in life, fundamentally comes back to trying to control the uncontrollable and set expectations on things that aren't our responsibility. Well, now, what do I mean by that? You might sort of have an expectation that by a certain age, you've achieved a certain thing at work or a certain amount of wealth or a certain amount of accomplishment, and life hasn't played that way. Okay, life hasn't played that way. What are we going to do about it? We can be frustrated by the fact that life didn't go to plan, or we adapt to it. Even something as simple as, actually, I fell into the expectation trap recently with something as simple as my wife and I had a concert that we were going to, and it was a 37-degree day. And we kind of looked and went, do we really want to go be standing outside in 37 degrees, or do we just want to go see the evening acts? And I found myself getting really frustrated that the weather wasn't plagued by my, you know, desires and my expectations of life. How dare it? How dare the weather not, you know, work to my plan so I could go see all these bands I wanted to see? And that's a minor example, but I would almost guarantee that if you sit down and write, what am I frustrated about lately? What has upset me lately? What has stressed me lately? A lot of the time it's expectations that are things that aren't ours to control. What that then leads to is another psychological pattern where we're under-responsible for the things we can control. So we're really over-responsible to these other things, other people's behavior, outcomes in life, but we're under-responsible for the things that are ours to take ownership of. So the example I give with this one is, you know, some people get frustrated that they haven't had a promotion in X amount of years. I'm like, well, actually getting the promotion is out of your control. You can't just walk in and demand it and say, yes, got a promotion, tick the box, now I'm happy for 3 months and then I set a new goal, right? But then you go, well, let's look at the inputs that make it more likely. Have you had a conversation about promotion? Have you defined what success would look like for you and your team and for your manager to know the benchmarks required for you to get said promotion? Like, these are all things that you can lead and take ownership of, and people haven't done them. And so it comes back to this idea of I fundamentally believe happiness is your own responsibility, but we all have an opportunity to influence each other's. So I am not responsible for the happiness of my team, my clients, my wife, my friends, my family, but I honor the fact that I have a role to play in influencing it. The way to think of this is, we're all on our own road trip in life. Like, they're all in the driver's seat of their own happiness. I get to be in the passenger seat with them. You know, I give them some snacks and some resources and point out some directions. But as soon as I feel I'm taking control and I'm like, oh, I'm taking responsibility for someone else's happiness, often that means I'm not taking ownership and responsibility for my own happiness and well-being. So that expectation trap and that under responsibility towards our own happiness are very common ones. Comparison, we've already spoken about, also a very, very, very common one. It's another form of expectation. And the beautiful thing is, the antidote to a lot of these is the same. Like, a lot of, be it expectation, comparison, under responsibility to self, over responsibility to others, the core solution to a lot of this is appreciation and self-awareness, right? It's reconnection to self. It's appreciating what we do have rather than lamenting what we don't have and wrestling with our expectations. There's a people saying that appreciation is the antidote to expectation. Now, whether you do that in the form of a gratitude practice, whether you just try to be a little bit more noticeable, whether you just try to be a bit more thankful in life, I think there's a real gap that we can see in society of we're very quick to judge and we're not as quick to be curious and compassionate. I think if we were quick to be compassionate and curious about people and experiences and decisions rather than so quick to judge, we might not have such like a polarized society that we're seeing at the moment. We might have a bit more of a connected society that's more conducive to happiness. But I mean, saying all of this, we're very capable of that, right? I see it day in, day out, people learning how to nurture appreciation over expectation, learning how to be curious instead of judgmental. And little nod to the listeners, if you've seen Ted Lasso, you'll know that's a saying from that show. When we practice these skills, it's just genuinely beneficial, not only for our own happiness, but for societal happiness and well-being too.
I was smiling when you were saying about the expectations. And I think what I've done in the past is I've set a massive audacious goal that, to be honest, was probably really never achievable in the time frame that I had set myself, right? And when I didn't meet it, even though I had grown and achieved still a lot, but I didn't hit the goal I wanted. It's like everything else went out the window. And what should have been a real like moment of like, I'm really proud of myself, I ended up literally spiraling and being so miserable, so like discontent, and just thought like, why aren't I good enough? And it's just sort of like led to this, like, you know, criticizing myself, you're not good enough, you're not this, you're not that. But actually what I had achieved in that time was
pretty amazing. That was, I'm going back sort of years ago now, but it's the expectations that we put on ourselves. And often it's society's timeline, like who set the timelines of by 30, we need to be married in the job. And then by our 40s, we need to have a great family and be mortgage free. Like who is setting these standards for our lives? And I think it all goes back to what you said at the start about that whole treadmill. And I think it comes back to self-awareness, because how many people climbing the wrong ladder, are climbing someone else's ladder, get to the top and go, oh, is this all there is? And I have been there twice in my life. And it is just like a real emptiness of like, oh, I thought that this was what the thing was going to be to make me feel different inside. And what I've come to realize is that nothing externally is ever going to fix what's going on internally, which is why the practices like meditation, journaling, gratitude are so important and are now practices in my daily life. But I'd love to talk to you now about some practices that people could maybe implement into their lives to just start feeling more contentment, happiness, inner peace. I just feel like there's so much. All you got to do is turn the news and you just go, oh my God, the world's going to end. So much negativity out there at the moment. I mean, step one, turn off the news. Don't turn the TV on. That's a start, right? But what else could they do? What's some of the things that you've done in your life that have had the most profound effects?
Yeah, so I'm actually going to start with something that I think is deceptively simple. And I think that's why people overlook it and undervalue it. And that is, make sure you're working with your physical health in a way that it supports your mental and emotional health. Mm. Now, it's not going to solve everything on its own, but I can promise you it is way harder to be happy and well if you're in physical pain, if you are underslept, if you're hungry and, you know, not nourishing your body. I'm sure we've all had moments where we've been a bit hangry and maybe had some emotional spillover on a loved one and gone, oh, that was not about you. That was because I did not have lunch today. It astounds me how often I see people go, okay, I'm feeling down, I'm not feeling happy, I'm not feeling well, and they immediately jump to a psychological solution to that, right? Of, I need to get in and unpack my thoughts, I need to journal, I need to practice. And look, that's all valuable, it's important, but if we come back to our fundamentals, have you stacked the deck in your favor? Have you made it more likely that you're going to be ill? And you don't have to overcomplicate it. You know, for me, what's worked really well is, am I drinking enough water? Right. Am I moving my body in some way that feels sustainable and good at least 30 minutes a day? Now, some weeks and some days, that's basketball. It's, you know, rigorous weights. Sometimes it's just stretching and yoga or a light walk with the dogs. Like, it doesn't have to be this rigid rule, but it's, for me, it's something I commit to for myself to give myself the best chance to feel good. And it's adequate sleep. If you do these three things well, you get enough water, you get adequate sleep, you move your body in some way, I'd say you're already going to be hell of a lot ahead of where you were in terms of making it likely that we feel happy. So start by getting your body feeling happy. Then we can move into the psychology practices and we can look at the mind, because it's hard to figure out our thoughts when we're physically not feeling well. It's also exceptionally difficult to figure out our thoughts and work through them if we're giving them a home ground advantage. What I mean by that is, don't try to solve your thoughts inside your own head, because you're only ever going to catch the tail end of them. We all have a negative cognitive bias where our brain goes to worst case scenario. Like, wrestling with our mind inside our mind is such a losing game. So whatever you need to do to get it out, be that talk therapy, working with a coach, counselor, therapist, professional of some sort, journaling, I know you've mentioned. For me, I talk a lot more than I write. I like to talk through my thoughts. So I use an app called Otter. It's free. I could literally just press record and I talk sometimes on a long car drive. I'll just talk about what's on my mind and it will transcribe it for me. And at the end of the week, I can look back and go, huh, 5 out of 5 days this week, I've been talking about the same topic. Maybe I should do something about that, right? It gives me visibility over my thoughts. So when it comes to what a practice we can do, get your thoughts out of your head, get your emotions out of yourself as well. Name them, right? There's a great saying, what we feel, we can heal. But if you're going to feel something, you need to name it first. So sometimes I throw out the line, name it to tame it. We have a huge gap in society at the moment when it comes to emotional literacy. So people actually being able to recognize and name their feelings. If you can't even recognize and name an emotion, how do we hope to understand it? How do we hope to manage it more effectively? Like, emotional intelligence, people think, oh, do I manage my emotions? Well, I'm like, first step is, can you name them? Like, can you tell me what the difference between feeling overwhelmed and anxious is? What does that actually feel like difference-wise? What about feeling annoyed versus frustrated? What's the difference between those two? Because they're close cousins, right? And so I think if people listening to this did only three things to maximize their likelihood of happiness, one, look after your physical happiness, you know, give yourself a fighting chance with your body. Two, get your thoughts out of your head, whether you do that through journaling, meditation, talk therapy. And three, expand your emotional literacy. Start naming your emotions. The best way to do this, I call it a two-word check-in because it cuts past all the thoughts. It just gets to the emotion. If you were to capture how you felt today in only two words, what two words would you use and why? It allows us to be a little bit curious and to expand, because eventually you'll get sick of writing the same two words every day and you'll start experimenting with other labels and names for our emotions. But if we can rapidly expand our emotional literacy, what will follow is emotional intelligence.
Really, really, really powerful. And I love what you said about the battle of the mind, because again, when I think back to when I was going through sort of that battle of anxiety, I was trying to challenge the thoughts, and then the thought would come out and I'd go, I don't want to think this. And I'd, you know, and then I was thinking it more because I was anxious about having the same thoughts all the time. And it's a vicious spiral. But when you're in it, like I was talking to a really good friend the other day, and they're going through a little bit of some hard time at the moment. And they're just in this thought loop. They're like, I can't break the loop. I can't break the loop. And then they feel it in their body. So it's like, first comes the thought, then comes the emotion, like the tight chestedness, the anxiety, the overwhelm. And it's like, how can we break when we're in that cycle of like thought, feeling, you've mentioned talk therapy, journaling, speaking to yourself. But in those moments when the mind does start to race, the heart starts to race, anything we can do right there and then to just try and not stop it. And maybe that's what we need to not do. So I'm curious to be like, what would you recommend if someone's in that spiral right now? How could they start to sort of overcome it in the moment?
And I think that you're right. The first thing is we need to reframe the intention here, because I promise you, if the thought is to stop the thought or the feeling, if that's the goal, you're going to lose. That's like getting in a boxing ring, putting the gloves on and going, I'm going to beat my thoughts and feelings into submission. And anyone who's been in a boxing match with your mind or feelings knows that you don't win that often. Right? It's a bit of a rough game to play. So I try to encourage people to think more about dancing with their thoughts and feelings rather than fighting with them. You know, a dance has give and take, it has lead and follow, it has this innate curiosity to it. And what that looks like is rather than going in going, okay, I need to solve this or fix this, it starts from the presupposition of I'm not broken. For everyone listening to this, you're not broken. You're not, you know, damaged as a person. I fundamentally don't believe that. I think over time people learn things and we build habits psychologically that once served a purpose that now maybe aren't so useful, but we can challenge them. We can change them. And so coming in with this innate self-compassion of I'm not broken, there's something here that I want to figure out and explore and find the positive intention behind it. Because I promise you, no one's brain wakes up in the morning and goes, today we're going to flood you with thoughts that ruin your day. I'm going to make you feel terrible about yourself and you're going to be fundamentally unhappy. The brain doesn't have that intention. In fact, interesting, I would argue the brain doesn't actually give a shit if you're happy. The brain cares that you're alive. Mm-hmm. And so we create these thoughts and feelings with positive intention. At some point, we spoke before, the positive intention of some of the self-criticism is, oh, well, that makes me perform more. It makes me more hungry for growth. I achieve more. I push more, right? That's a positive intention. Is that intention being met by telling ourselves that we're not good enough? Arguably, maybe, but is there a better way to get there? Probably, right? And so when we start with a presupposition of self-compassion rather than self-judgment, we have a lot more room to play with. Another good way to do this specifically with thoughts, and you mentioned it a little bit, is if we come at our thoughts with, I'm not allowed to think that or don't think that, same with our feelings, it creates a snowball effect. So, you know, let's say the start feeling is anxious, and then we judge ourselves for feeling anxious. Well, now we're stressed that we're anxious. And then we judge the stress. Now we're frustrated that we're stressed that we're anxious. And before you know it, we're overwhelmed by how frustrated we are about the stress of anxiety. Whereas if we just went, hey, I am feeling anxious right now, and that's okay, and I want to get curious about that. Well, now I'm just dealing with the anxiety. I'm not dealing with this snowball of other emotion. And so now I can do something with it. Same thing happens with thoughts, the experiment, and everyone who's listening to this conversation, you can play along. You're going to hate me for it, but you'll thank me one day, hopefully. There's an experiment called the Brown Bear Experiment, where we go, We tell our mind that it can think anything it wants. For the rest of today, it can think about anything, but it fundamentally cannot think about a brown bear. Chances are you're already thinking of the brown bear and you're already frustrated that you lost the game. But what's interesting is we know from studies that you are now statistically more likely to notice pictures of a brown bear over the next 24 hours, to see a storybook about a brown bear, to hear someone mention a bear, to see an ad on TV about Alaska and there's a bear in it. Like, your mind is now wired to look for the brown bear because we told it that it was so important to not think of it. It's the saying is, what we resist will persist. Now, that's trivial and kind of funny when it comes to a brown bear. But what if the thought was, you know, don't think negative things about yourself? Well, you're now statistically more likely to think those thoughts and to have them linger and stay for longer than if we just went, hey, I'm allowed to think those thoughts. It's very human too. Now let's get curious about it. So as a long-winded answer to your question, I think the first thing we need to do is actually try to drop judgment and lean in with compassion and curiosity. And then when we're there, anything we can do to bring ourselves back to the present moment. So mindfulness practices, you know, focusing on our breathing, tuning into our senses, coming back into the current moment, because a lot of the time the challenges that we have with the mind aren't just driven by this self-judgment. They're also driven by our mind liking to run way off into the future or way back into the past, right? And so if we just bring it back to the present for a moment, because, you know, I'm a big believer that it's not the goal for us to all be perfectly practicing monks who are present 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. I don't know if you can go to town, but I don't think that's really viable. I think what's more useful is, can I re-presence myself and re-presence my mind when it is running rogue? If we can do that, sure, we've then got a lot of space and opportunity to do the other tools and techniques.
Yeah, that's really, really, really powerful. And hopefully if my friend's listening, that's very helpful as well, because I know that I'm always keeping a pulse on what's going on in the world and what I'm hearing and what people are going through. And like I said to you at the start, there does seem to be a lot more people struggling right now with, call it mental health, call it, you know, depression, anxiety, overwhelm, burnout. Like, it does seem to be these words are being thrown around a lot. And I'll be honest, if I look back throughout my life, up until probably at the age of about 21, 22, I didn't even know what these words were: anxiety, depression, mental health. I think it's really good that we're talking about it a lot. But sometimes I think, are we talking about it too much? Like, I was thinking about it the other day. I was like, I didn't even know what anxiety meant until I one day was in the pharmacist thinking that I was generally dying, but I was just having a panic attack. And she said, oh, you're just having an anxiety attack. But I didn't know what it was. And now it's everywhere. Like you just said about the brown bear, are we too focused on these depression, anxiety? Are we going to the extreme of, like, let's talk about it all the time? Are we overdoing it? I was just curious about that as you were speaking then, because it does seem to be everywhere at the moment, in the back of the toilet doors. Are you struggling with this and this and this? It's in our face a lot. And I was thinking, is it too much in our face now? I think it's great that we're having open conversations and mental health being talked about. I think it's really, really important. But are we overdoing it as a society now? I'd love your thoughts on that.
I love that we're having this conversation, Georgie. This is something that I feel so passionately about. I'm going to answer with two things. Okay. So firstly, I agree to a degree. What I mean by that is, I think we have lived through about a 15 to 20 year era of mental health awareness, where the primary goal was increase awareness around, actually, its primary goal has been increase awareness around mental health challenges, which I would actually call mental ill health. Very important. Like, let's look at the spectrum of minus 10 to neutral. How do we help people through that? How do we help people recover from that? Super important work has happened there. I'm so grateful we've had a 2-decade run, but that's the focus. What I hope for is the next era that we're entering is an expansion of what it means to be mentally healthy, not just looking at mental ill health and going from minus 10 to neutral, but also looking at mental flourishing. So what does it mean to take people from neutral to plus 10? Because there's a lot more to life than just feeling mentally okay and getting by. We need to look at, how do we help people thrive? How do we help people feel their best? How do we help people fulfill their potential? How do we help people be happy, right? And so I hope we're entering an era where our definition of mental health actually expands to be a much broader spectrum. I also hope we're entering an era where the focus shifts from only mental health awareness to mental health action, So this is tangibly what to do to improve mental health and support positive mental health outcomes, to an era of mental health advocacy, which is pushing for policy change, which is standing up and pushing for resourcing. And on that note, moving into an era of mental health accessibility. I think it is wrong for us to talk only about mental health awareness when the wait list to see professionals can be exhaustingly long and the cost of seeing the professionals is prohibitively high. And so I think we need to look at the last two decades has been so important. I don't want to take away from the accomplishments and successes of what we've done as a society and what, as a profession, mental health professionals have done and going, we need to talk about this more. I hope we're now moving from talking to these other things that we need to practice as well. The other thing I was going to share with this is kind of on the mental health accessibility point. I think we need to stop viewing happiness and mental health as an individual challenge to solve. Now, I know I said before, I fundamentally believe everyone's happiness is their personal responsibility, but we all have a role to play in each other's. We know that we influence and impact each other's happiness. So what that looks like to me is, are we creating societies and workplaces and communities and schools and homes that are conducive to happiness? Now, what people do with that, that's an individual and personal responsibility. But when we look at things like the cost of living, right? We know that financial stress is one of the biggest detractors to people's happiness and well-being. And up to a point, money literally does buy happiness up till a certain income per year, and then it really levels out and doesn't make too much of a difference. If we know this, well, that's something that we need to solve, right? We know that physical health and well-being, we know that commuting more than 45 minutes each way to a job is a detractor to happiness. So are we designing cities and livable spaces where there's enough employment opportunities where people don't have to be commuting for more than 45 minutes each way to get to their job? Right? We know that connection to nature is conducive to happiness. So are we making that accessible to people? Like, I think there's a lot that we can do around policy design. Actually, I'll shout out a fantastic book on this called The Nordic Edge. It was written by two Australian researchers who studied the Scandinavian countries, which are often at the top of the world's happiest countries, and went, what are they doing systemically? Like, what are they doing as a society to make happiness more likely, that then individuals can then, you know, take that opportunity and drive their happiness themselves? And I think there's some fantastic research in there around what we could do from a policy level as well. So yeah, in answer to your question, are we talking about too much? I think yes, to a degree. I think we need to expand our definition and move into, you know, rather than just mental health awareness, mental health action, mental health advocacy and mental health accessibility. And that accessibility piece means we need to be bold and courageous to have the policy conversations and the systemic conversations rather than just viewing happiness as an individual pursuit.
No, I think it's just a really important conversation to have, because I've just been thinking about it quite a bit recently, and it's one of the reasons why I wanted to get you on to have this conversation, because I think, like, you know, once you become aware of something, then you can, if you don't have then the help, that can actually make it sometimes worse. Like, sometimes it's almost better to be unconscious of what's going on in your mind. What I've found, interestingly, happy to be vulnerable, is the more self-aware I've become of my thoughts, the more I've realized sometimes when I'm just sat and I could just be reading, I could be on the beach, I could be having such a moment of joy. And within a split second, it's like, I don't know if you've read Gay Hendricks, The Big Leap. He talks about your upper limit. Mm-hmm. And he talks about your baseline of happiness, right? Like, we're all born with this sort of like thermostat. And when our thermostat reaches a higher point, our upper limit clicks in and we do something to bring ourselves down. And I've been so aware of this throughout my life, because in a moment where I felt joy, I've been sat on the beach, I've been with my husband, with my dog, and we're just having a moment, drinking a nice coffee. And all of a sudden I'll just have a thought about, what if my dog gets run over by that car? And all of a sudden I'm sat there in this beautiful moment that I've just been enjoying perfectly. And then I've had this thought, and then I've spiraled, I've grabbed Ted, I'm, you know, in control freak mode. Why do we do this? Like, do you think there's some sort of like, and again, this, I'm sure there's some science on this, so maybe it's just a theory I have, but this baseline that we have, and then every time we sort of go to experience these high levels of joy, or we want to experience more happiness, but we sort of, what I do anyway, find I bring myself down to maybe the baseline that I have sort of developed for myself. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah. So two thoughts on this. One is set point theory, which is what you're describing there of we have this set point notion of happiness. Now, you know, whether that is something that's genetic, whether that's something as a result of how we were raised in childhood, we could have the nature versus nurture, free will versus determinism debate for thousands of years. We literally have been having that debate for thousands of years as a species. So I won't get into that, but we do know that people tend to have a set point of happiness. And we see that time and time again. There's studies where people win the lotto and their happiness goes through the roof. And then 3 to 6 months later, they're back roughly where they were before winning the lotto in terms of how satisfied they rate their life. Big major life disruptions and traumas, you know, have a plummet to people's happiness. 3 to 6 months later, they're relatively close to where they were rating their life happiness and satisfaction overall beforehand. And now that can be a little bit, I find that a bit defeating sometimes of like, oh, so nothing that I do matters because it's always going to return to baseline in 3 to 6 months. Well, to a degree, because rather than it just thinking of a set point, what we're starting to see more in the research now is like a set range. So we might have people who are kind of like naturally a little bit more stoic and their set range is like -2 to +2 on the spectrum. Like there's not much emotional movement there. We might have people who are more natural optimists and their set range might be -2 to +8. And then we might have people who are natural pessimists who are -8 to +2. For me, I think regardless of where your natural set range is, if you do the work and, you know, practice the tools and the techniques to put yourself on the higher end of your set range more often than not, you're going to feel happier. Like it actually doesn't matter what your set range is. It matters how often are you in the higher end of your set range and how quickly can you address and overcome when you're in the lower end of your set range. Right? If we can do that, chances are we feel better than otherwise. The other thing we know is we can actually change and expand our set range mainly through those physical practices that we've mentioned. So exercise and meditation are the two tools that above everything else are shown to change people's set range of happiness. And so I'd say if you're not practicing those, start practicing some form of meditation and mindfulness. It doesn't have to mean shaving your head and sitting cross-legged under a waterfall or a Bodhi tree, right? Like it just means do some form of meditation and mindfulness practice, do some form of exercise. If you're doing those two things, your set range is more likely to skew on the higher end. Just genetically, we know it puts us on a better thing. Like we can talk about the science with what happens neurochemically with the brain, but let me just say it stacks the deck in your favor. So we need to do that. So there's the set range theory. The other thing is it comes back to what I was mentioning before about your brain doesn't actually care that you're happy. Your brain cares that you're alive, which means we all have something that in happiness literature is called the negative cognitive bias. I just call it the worst case thinker. Like our brain's really good at going, what could go wrong? Case in point, sitting at the beach, lovely day. What could go wrong here? My dog could be hit by a car, right? Like our brain does that so well. And that was useful thousands of years ago because it's what allowed us to stay alive and pass on our genetics and, you know, have children. And, you know, that's what kept the species going. The challenge is the negative cognitive thinking trap, that part of our brain, right, that negative cognitive bias, now struggles to tell the difference between there is a tiger about to maul me and my family and I have an email that I'm not sure about the wording of from my boss, right? The response is nearly the same in our brain. And so, again, meditation mindfulness can help with this. A lot of the brain training tools can help with this. But suffice to say, I think if we come at this going, okay, my brain is a little wired towards worst case scenario, I need to now train it and work on changing that, which we know we can, thanks to neuroplasticity, we can change the brain. Best ways to do that, everything we've been speaking about today, you know, self-awareness, emotional intelligence, emotional literacy, journaling, gratitude practice is a great one for rewiring that part of the brain. All of these tools are essentially trying to solve the same two core problems, which is I have a baseline or base set point or set range for happiness. How do I increase it? And my brain is going to want to sit naturally on the bottom end of my set range because that keeps me alive. How do I try to encourage it and nudge it to sit a little more on the higher end?
I'm so glad we've gone here because this is something that I know I'm not alone in doing because my best friend does this as well. Like she was saying, like, I think I'm a bit nuts. I was like, no, you're not. We all do it. Like, worst case scenario. It's a really important conversation to have. And yeah, exercise. There's not a day that goes by that you won't see me walking, weight training, on my bike, out in nature. It's one source of joy that I have. And I just feel so good. Like, I just think sometimes just move, just get up and move and you'll just feel so good. And it doesn't have to be, like you said, like really intense, but just go for a walk around the block or a light jog or just do something, because you do feel the benefits. And if you can have some sort of, like, you know, call it like mental hygiene practice, like a meditation practice, a gratitude practice, like that also can just boost as well. So I just love everything you just said then. But just finally, before I let you go, and I'd love to have you back on as well, Declan, because I just talked to you for hours about this, but let's just quickly talk about work now, because we spend, you know, a massive majority of our time in our lives in our workplaces. And it can be such a double-edged sword. Work can bring so many people joy and fulfillment, but it can also bring with it a lot of stress, unease, and unhappiness. So if someone's listening to this right now, and I have a lot of career professionals that, you know, some love their job, some are looking for a new job, but how can we just be happier in our workplaces? Is it our responsibility? Is there something more the companies could be doing? What does the research tell us?
Yeah. So this is an area I stumbled into accidentally through my research. So I've been working with individuals to help them learn the skills and science of happiness since 2016. And then in late 2019, one of our junior year members at the college, so he was in his third year at BU Happiness College learning those skills for himself, went, "I think my workplace needs this." And I went, "Okay, cool. Someone else will help with that." And he goes, "No, like, I want you to come and work with our team." I went, "I've never worked with an organization." And so he goes, "Well, treat it like a group of people learning a set of skills, like what you've been teaching me about burnout, about stress management, about all these concepts and tools that have been helping me a lot. Can you do that on a systemic level with the organization?" And it was funny timing, because that happened in November 2019. Now, we know what happened a few months after that in terms of dramatically shifting the way we work, dramatically shifting our relationship with work, and dramatically changing the expectation people have on the employee experience, on going, actually, this matters. And so that led to this really accelerated, this actually what I did my master's research in, was how is happiness even defined in a workplace setting and who is responsible for it? How do we measure it? How do we drive it? What I landed on was, there's almost two competing arguments. We look at top-down change, which is what I was mentioning before about happiness is not an individual thing to solve. We need to look at the systemic contributors. I think too many organizations go, "Oh, we're going to solve disengagement and poor well-being at work with some yoga sessions and some healthy lunches." And don't get me wrong, they're useful to have. But if the problem is, you know, you have a terrible relationship with your boss and the workload is fundamentally unsustainable, that's not going to solve the issue. Right. So we've got to look systemically there. So top down, really important. We need executives and leaders who are bold enough and brave enough to go, happiness matters to us and employee experience matters. And we're going to look at our role in it. And we need bottom up. Bottom up is individuals taking the ownership, because if we don't have the bottom up, it's going to feel, and I've seen this in workplaces, I've seen frontline teams who are, the trust level is so low in the workplace that you go, "Hey, management wants us to roll out these changes," and there's immediate skepticism. Right? Like, "Oh, well, what's in it for them? Why do they want us to do this stuff?" Right. And so we do need this level of bottom-up personal ownership of, "I am choosing to do this for my happiness and my well-being." And what that then leads to in the workplace is just a nice side effect. If we can bring those two together, if we can get workplaces that we look at top-down systemic change, but we also look at bottom-up solutions like learning and development initiatives, that plays really well together. And in terms of whose responsibility is that, I often say to leaders and executives, I'm like, "Hey, your responsibility is to create an environment that's conducive to a positive employee experience and conducive to happiness in the workplace. What then happens from that is the individual responsibility of everyone on the team, right? To take ownership of and to utilize and to practice and to uphold and to contribute to." I'd also argue it's not just the workplace's responsibility to create that positive environment. It is their strategic advantage too. All the research shows us that when people are happy at work, their, you know, your costs in terms of employee retention and attraction and recruitment just like is so much better. There's some, depending on the research you look at, it's anywhere between $2.67 to $3.27 return on investment for every dollar that's put into workplace happiness. Now, I'm not a gambling man, but I don't know too many places, but let's call it on average between those $2-$3. I don't know too many places where you can go in and say, "Hey, there's going to be a 300% return on investment in this over 12 months. Like, if that was a stock, people would be just absolutely pumping money into it. And when you can sit down with organizations and show them the numbers and go, here's the evidence, here's the proof. Like, why aren't we doing this? It suddenly becomes a bit of a no-brainer. And my hope, I'm just going to admit to this on the podcast. This is the first time I'm going to just say this so bluntly. So buckle in, everyone. My intention, my whole purpose of my career is to grow global happiness. How do we make the world as a whole a happier place? Now, I fundamentally cannot do that alone. And so we started Be Your Happiness Coach to go, well, let's help individuals learn those skills. Then we ended up working with organizations as of 2019 and went, how do we help organizations measure, understand, and enhance happiness? My sneaky long game with this is I genuinely believe the more workplaces that value employee experience, value happiness, that enable their team to thrive at work, I think the trickle effect that that's going to have on society is insane. To your point, our work can be the biggest source of stress for a lot of people, of exhaustion. And there's a great saying, often people's workplace gets the best of them and the rest of life gets what's left of them. My hope is, well, what if we were setting up workplaces that enabled people to bring their best selves to work and still have enough in the tank to bring their best selves to their marriages, to their parenting, to their community pursuits? Like, the world as a whole, society as a whole, just gets better when we solve the workplace happiness issue. And so I've never been more hopeful or energized for what we do, because I'm seeing it in real time. I'm seeing organizations that go, yes, happiness matters. We're going to take a top-down approach where we are held accountable to this. The best organizations I've partnered with have done this by, they measure employee happiness and employee experience through really evidence-based comprehensive tools, and their executives have financial bonuses tied to that. So there is a financial cost to the leaders and executives and board if their people are fundamentally unhappy at work. That is the gold standard for top-down change. And then I see great organizations doing bottom-up change where they're enabling their team to have choice over work flexibility, over what skills and tools they're learning and developing, over even how they use their initiatives. So like some workplaces that I'm partnered with have employee happiness budget that's just included in each person's salary. And they say, that's for you to use for what you want. If you want to use it to go have discounted gym sessions, go to town. If you want to use it to put towards a professional development course and a skill you're learning, go to town. Like, they give people ownership over their happiness and journey rather than just one blanket rule for all their staff. And I think that works really well. But again, I'm seeing in real time organizations doing a top-down and bottom-up approach and just reaping the rewards. They're standing as an employer of choice. They're getting better talent. They're keeping people for longer, and they're performing at a higher capacity.
I just love this, because I've been doing recruitment now for 12 years and you hear it all. I've got my own agency as well. I've been running that for 7 years. I always ask when a candidate's looking, why are you looking for work? Don't feel appreciated. It's punishment over praise. I'm overworked. I'm underpaid. I'm undervalued. Like, it's just, I don't have a life. I'm working, 14 hours. It's like, a lot of it is that they just don't feel appreciated at all. And then the work isn't meaningful. There's no compelling vision. There's no mission. It's just like, they literally come to work. Here's your desk. Here's your pay slip. And people want more than that now. Yeah. People want to feel like they're coming to work. It's meaningful. They're working in a collaborative, inclusive team where everyone, like you say, can be an individual. And it is, I think we need to move away from like seeing people as profit, and we actually need to really start thinking about people as individuals. What do these people need? How can we make the organization better? What can we do as an organization to make people want to work here, stay here? It's not difficult, but companies just need to get started. And I love that whole bottom down, top down approach, because if you don't have the leadership team on board with this, it's not going to work. And if the individuals are exhausted, burnt out and defeated, they're also not going to want to do anything either. So it works both ways, but it is so worth investing in, like you said, because when you get this right, your company, your services, your products, everything is going to excel. And the business and the profit will go up if you invest in your people. And I think every single company should really, really be thinking about their attraction and their retention strategies. And they just don't. And then when you work with a business that says, we're losing all of our staff, and the first thing I'll sort of like dig into is like, well, what are some challenges you're facing? It's like red flag, red flag, red flag, red flag. Mm-hmm. So what you just said then is so powerful.
I'm glad you shared in your experience too, like, you know, 12 years in this space, you would have had thousands of conversations with people.
Yeah.
I would hazard a bet. Now, I'm not a gambling man, but if I was, I'd put some money on this, that out of those 1,000 conversations, 99.9% of them, the core question is, or the core desire there is, I believe I would be happier working elsewhere.
100%.
Now, what that manifests as, whether it's more money, more respect, more appreciation, better working hours, the core question or the core thing is, I fundamentally believe I would be happier working elsewhere. And so for leaders and managers and organizations, the question is fundamentally answer the question, do you think that your team would be happier working elsewhere? And if the answer is yes, you got to start solving that. You got to start going, okay, well, how do we make ourselves a compelling place for happiness?
And it's interesting because it's a feeling you get when you walk into these organizations. You can't almost, I can instantly feel, oh, something's going on here. And then I walk into another business and I go, oh, this feels great. Everyone's smiling and laughing and collaborating and chatting. It's fascinating. The amount of buildings I've gone into over the years and gone, oh, this feels a bit strange, or oh, this feels great. You can instantly tell, can't you?
Yeah.
But look, Declan, it's been such a joy having you on, and you've definitely made me feel happier today. I feel like this has been such a great conversation and hopefully some really tangible things for people to really take away. But just final question, has there been anything today that we haven't spoken about that you just want to leave the audience with before we wrap up today?
I think we spoke about it a little bit, but I'll hammer it home as a final message. The most important thought is start thinking of happiness as a skill. Start thinking of it as something that you can learn, that you can invest in, that you can develop and practice. And look, like any skill, it means you're going to stuff it up a lot at the start. You know, you might try meditation and mindfulness, like we spoke about today, and go, wow, I suck at this. Good, you're meant to. Keep going, right? Or you might go, actually, you know what? I don't set up my physical happiness to be, well, I haven't looked at hydration and exercise and sleep, and I'm going to do that today. Expect yourself to suck at it for a bit. You're meant to. That is part of skill development, but stick with it. It is so worth it. And I promise you, the more time and effort and resources that you put into learning and mastering the skills and science of happiness, not only the happier do you become, but the more you're able to play your part in spreading that ripple effect of happiness. And then we all get to work together to make the world a happier place.
Beautifully put. Where can I send people to find out more about you, your services, and what you offer? Where do you hang out the most?
Where I hang out the most these days is LinkedIn, but really any social platform. If you search Declan Edwards, BU Happiness College, or That Happiness Guy, I'll tend to pop up. We also have our own podcast now as well called How to Be Happy. So if you search How to Be Happy, you can learn all about the skills and science of happiness there. We do an episode, every second episode is about individual happiness, and then the other episodes are about workplace happiness. So whether you're more looking for the personal development side or the professional development side, it's all covered there. And then of course, if you go to buhappinesscollege.com, you can find a bunch of free resources and tools there as well.
Amazing. We'll make sure we put all the links below, and please everyone go and connect with Declan, and thank you so much. It's been such a great conversation.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for listening to today's episode. If you've got this far, that honestly means the world to me and lets me know that you've got a lot of value from today's episode. So if I could just ask you to do one thing, pull out your phone and please leave a quick review. It honestly would mean the world to me. It will help this podcast grow and get our message out there to more people. So if you could do that for me, that would be amazing. And please reach out and just let me know what you want to hear more about, what you're interested in. It will just also help me make sure that I'm continuing to speak to topics that are relevant and also find guests that are real true experts in what you want to know more about. So have an amazing day. Thank you so much for doing that. And I can't wait to share the next episode with you. Thank you.